89-1522, Wisconsin Conference Board of Trustees of the United Methodist Church, Inc. versus Ronald Culver et al. And Lan Waddell will represent Mr. Culver and will speak for 25 minutes. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. Members of the court, members of the ELO congregation, citizens of the state, we're here today on a case which is coming up off of a motion to dismiss and a motion for a summary judgment where the motion to dismiss was granted and the motion to summary judgment was denied. The gravamen of that complaint was a statute, 187-15(4). Underlying facts are that ELO United Methodist Church was a longstanding Methodist church, small church out in the country, came to a difference with the state body, the plaintiff, who through all of the briefing we've referred to as the UMC, the United Methodist Church, to keep it tight and short. And they declared that they were no longer United Methodist and informed the annual conference or the UMC of that fact. The UMC brought an action declaring that the statute in question provided that they should receive the property. The motion to dismiss followed, the motion for summary judgment followed that, there was a hearing, and the trial court judge on that basis dismissed the complaint. We're here today, we've come to the Court of Appeals, of course, and we're here today to have this court define for attorneys and parties into the future what is the true meaning of 187-15(4) when viewed from these or similar facts. We believe the position of ELO is that first off, that it has a plain meaning. The triggering words is ELO defunct and dissolved have a plain meaning. That it's the ordinary meaning, that is the building empty and the congregation dispersed and disappeared. That that's not ambiguous and to get past that is difficult. That second, that to give it any other meaning starts to bump against constitutional constraints. The first being the constitutional constraints we find in Lemon versus Kurtzman, that we can't get into the area of the statute has to have a secular purpose, it has to have a primary effect that neither advances nor inhibits religion, and we also cannot create an excessive entanglement between government and religion. The second part of our constitutional problem, I think, is that we can't have a statute that impermissibly creates a deprivation of property contrary to our own state constitution.
Counsel, I don't mean to interrupt, but I will. I have a question, and I want to talk about the property, just the deed itself, which is on Exhibit C, Appendix 125. And is it your argument, and I'm looking at from a property, from a deed standpoint, that the, let's see, it says the Methodist Episcopal Church of the Liberty Prairie Circuit Wisconsin Conference. Is your argument that that Methodist Episcopal Church refers, is not the United Methodist Church, but refers to the ELO Church? Is that basically what your argument under the deed itself?
That is true, Your Honor, and I would ask that the court look at the face of that deed. The first reference to who the grantor is says to the trustees of the Methodist Episcopal Church of Liberty Prairie Circuit. The second reference says to said trustees and their successors in office, trustees in trust for the Methodist Episcopal Church.
Okay.
But then the very next thing as we go down, it makes a reference. It says, should the Wisconsin Conference of the Methodist Episcopal Church neglect or fail to do various things? To me, the first two references are to the local church, and the next reference is to the statewide body. Then it jumps To the next place in the deed, it says, after further recitations of instructions in the deed, it says, said trustees may make use or disposition of the property, and it tells how they can do it if things fail. But then they get down to where they're saying, by donating or holding it for some other evangelical church. And I think it's saying, we're giving it to the local people to use for a church, but the intent of the donor and the recipient is that the control stays with the recipient, local church.
So then how significant is it, and this is my follow-up question, that in 1968 when you joined the United Methodist Church, that the trustees, I assume, if I've got my facts correct, refused or did not, they didn't go along with signing any new deed, any new trust deed. So the only deed we're dealing with is the one that I referred to, correct?
That is true, but
there was, as I understand the facts, others, there were six or so congregations went in at that time, but Elo was the only one, if the facts are correct, that did not agree to sign a new trust deed.
I can agree with you as far as...
I just want to know if that is...
It is significant. I believe so.
Okay.
I believe it's significant in several ways. One, it shows they have a continuing intent to remain independent as to their property. It shows the then-present intent of the UMC to say, we don't have as much as we would like, and we would like that trust deed to lock up our position. I think it's instructive in both cases. The one thing I have hesitation is I don't have knowledge, and I don't believe the record would show of a demand for trust deeds beyond just the relationship between ELO and the UMC. I don't have that knowledge.
Thank you.
At that juncture, when that trust deed was requested, that was almost simultaneous with this union of the Evangelical United Brethren and the United Methodist. And at that time, in their own documents in the discipline, there's much discussion how properties should be held and they should be held in trust and we anticipate them coming back. There's lots of that language. But there's language at paragraph 6 that provides that nothing in this union is to be construed to require any local church to alienate or in any way change the title to property contained in its deed. I don't know how I can read that in a way that doesn't say we acknowledge that some local churches have their own property rights that are not reversionary, and that we're not going to, as we create this merger, we're not going to force those people to give those up. And then they turned right around and said to one of the local churches, Elo, we would like to have that trust deed. That seems logical. And Elo said, no, we don't care to do that. That, I think, is very instrumental in how to be looking at this case at this moment.
Well, to what extent are we barred from looking at the discipline and the provisions therein, or any of the church hierarchical doctrines or provisions under the First Amendment to the Constitution?
Okay. I believe the First Amendment, and the First Amendment as we're seeing it interpreted in the series of cases, Jones versus Wolfe, and then all the things that spin out of it, I think that we're not barred from looking, but we need to look at it in the, they say, in a secular viewpoint. You can't look at it as, is this discipline supported by the Bible? You have to look at it and say, is this an agreement that is enforceable? Has it been met? My reading is that you can look, and you're being invited to look by the plaintiff here. They're saying the discipline provides that the property comes back, and that should be controlling. I think that neutral principles of law let us do that and instruct this court to do that, but at the same time, I don't think that they say give a complete deference to the decisions of that body. And in this case, when I look at things, I'm ready to say, jeepers, we've got a discipline that's internally inconsistent. In one place it says individuals or individual congregations can hold their property as their local property, and in other places it's saying we want it back. And I think that this court, in virtually any other case, would say whoever drafts bears the responsibility of clearing up the questions, the ambiguities, and so on. And I think that would be held against them if a person were to look at it that way. But I don't think that we're barred, and you're barred, from looking at the discipline. But I do believe that there's a solution to this case.
What is that, Counsel?
The solution to this case is the day they asked for the trust deed in the late 60s, and it was refused, they turn around and say, if we don't get a trust deed, we're not going to service you. We're not going to send you a pastor. We won't send you Sunday school materials. You cannot use our emblems, and you cannot hold yourself out to be United Methodist. The burden is so light to do that. If the intention of both sides of this, of a local congregation and a statewide body, is that I want to encourage people to donate, and one way I'll do that is let them know this will be a United Methodist Church forever. We'll put that right on the face of our deed, or we'll quick claim it into that form. They could do that so easy, and we wouldn't be here today. We don't find many of these cases because that's most frequently done.
Okay, but now after you were asked for the deed, you still remained a Methodist Church. Your client was still a Methodist Church.
We didn't ask for it. We refused it.
No, you refused it. But now, did you use the emblem? Did you get the Sunday school material?
True.
Okay, so you continued on as part of the UMC?
Yes.
Okay. Even though you didn't do the deed. Now, if you were going to write this opinion, how would you write it so that, obviously, so your client wins, but so that it makes good sense from a legal standpoint? Would you write that, look, on the basis of this deed, we've got conflicting provisions in the deed, some point to the UMC, some point to the local trustees, we've got the discipline that you mentioned, the provision that indicated that you didn't sign over, it's okay, you don't get the trust, and then these are neutral principles, just plain trust and property principles. Is that how you'd write it, or did you write
it? Not exactly.
Good. You tell me how.
Okay. First off, I think that people would have to torture the deed to say that it's ambiguous. It's difficult to read, but there's a difference. As I went through and Justice Wilcox asked the initial questions there, it goes through the local, and then it talks about a statewide body, and then it goes back and talks about if the statewide body doesn't, then the local people should. I don't know how we can make that deed ambiguous or confusing. Difficult to read, it's handwritten, the best copy we get, but that I go. My version of your opinion would be to say that 187.15.4, defunct and dissolved, has its plain meaning. If a local church goes out of business and there's nobody there to care for the real estate, it isn't going to disappear because the real estate taxes will come due. It just means that what will happen is then it would go back to the UMC if its last affiliation was UMC. That's all the further that the statute goes. That there's no constitutional problems with the statute, I don't believe, at that point. Now, the next thing that I put in there is that under neutral principles of law, I have read maybe 40 cases completely and skimmed others regarding how to handle this on neutral principles of law. And I could string together a site going either way here. I know that, and I'm not being critical of the plaintiff's recitation of the holdings of different courts and out-of-state courts and U.S. Supreme Court as those go. But I think the right way to have it done is to say the burden is so low that to have the parties, if their intention is reversion, have them do it at the Register of Deeds office. My problem is we ordered a title commitment, and the title commitment says it's in the local church. We talked in this case at different times, you'll see reference to Waukaw, another small community that had, for about 10 years or 15 years out of the last 150, they've been hooked with them. Waukaw sold their parsonage. Did they come back to the UMC to get it okayed? Not necessary.
I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. What time, what was the date on that title insurance? 1982?
No, it would have been about 1997. I do not have it in front of me, but it would be in that era, 97 or 98. There were two different policies.
All right. I have another question. You're relying on 187.15.4. Now, that statute was not in existence in 1860 and the date of this deed. And 187.02 says, and I'll paraphrase it, that if you were incorporated before then, or you're in existence before Chapter 187 was adopted, then the statute that was in existence when you came into existence will govern. And that's, 187.02, I think, is not raised in the briefs, but the concept that 187.15 doesn't govern this was raised in the briefs. What's your response to that?
My response is the answer is in this court's opinion in Frankie versus Mann, where it says the language in the deed controls, that it locks up both sides of the bargain. It's about a 1900 case here in the state.
Is it in your brief?
It's in the brief, and in the cases referred to in both briefs.
Right.
Okay. That basically says that the deed locked up for all time the flexibility of the parties. And quite honestly, as an attorney, I find that somewhat problematic. But I think it answers the question here, that the way I would read it is the deed between the parties trumps that statute, because I'm only willing to convey to this neighbor who wants to have a church on certain terms. I want to know that if I'm going to give it to him for a dollar, that he's going to use it for a church and under these terms, and maybe I'm of one denomination and I want it there. Here it says for an evangelical church. It doesn't say only a Methodist or any certain type of Methodist church. It says for some other evangelical church.
So you're saying your deed really trumps 187.15.42 also?
I believe that it's the statute can't take away what the grantor and the grantee agreed to do or not to do, and they mapped out to some length what happens under different kinds of circumstances, what I agree I will do with the church if you'll sell it to me.
If it's just the deed, then the argument that you advanced initially, which is plain meaning of the statute, seems like a secondary argument to you, plain meaning of the statute 187.15.4. Is that your primary argument, as you initially set forth here today, the plain meaning of that?
I believe the plain meaning of the deed is more determinative of the outcome of the case, but my problem is 187.15.4 has had no interpretation. That when I went to ELO the very first time I met with them, I ran a Westlaw stats annotated search, and I got the statute, and I don't have cases which interpreted this particular statute or its predecessors, which surprised me, but which leads me to believe that maybe it is just a statute for clearing it. One of the key cases that's in the plaintiff's brief is CAPE, which deals with a church out at Platteville, a Methodist church which the local people decided they wanted to become Congregationalist, wanted to become more independent. It was a dispute between the local levels, between the people who wanted to remain Methodist and the people who wanted to be independent of the Methodist, essentially, and use this Congregationalist route to get there. But to me, I assume the attorneys in the turn of the century could have came back and said, well, it pursuant to statute, it's defunct and dissolved. But I think they saw, well, there's 100 people here. It's hard to be defunct and dissolved with a crowd.
I want to follow up on the chief's question, and that is, I think when we're looking at 187.15 sub 4, that came into effect in 1923. ELO, I believe, dates back to 1860. I look at 187.15 sub 5, and that provision seems to grandfather in, if you will, churches that predate the enactment of the statute. That is, if they're incorporated under certain of these provisions. When did ELO incorporate? Is that in the record? And is it incorporated in under any of the provisions set forth in sub 5 that would grandfather in?
I don't know as to the incorporation, but in response to your raising sub 5 as grandfathering in, my response would be, is that is going to have a hard time getting past Article 1, Section 13 of the Constitution, that it's going to take property away from ELO. And another problem it has is that it's pretty darn helpful to the Methodist Church for the state to provide statutes which give property to a church. I think you have a little problem with your Lemon versus Kurtzman test that the primary effect would be to advance or inhibit religion. I think that if we go that direction interpreting this body of statutes, we have some real problems passing constitutional muster.
Well, 187.15.5 says that you're subject to the jurisdiction and discipline of a Methodist church. I think that's a problem.
I think that it's very plain on its face. I'll be the first to acknowledge it. But I think it's for this court to say, is that a statute that we can read to take property away from A and give it to B, where the clear face of the deed is that B doesn't have an interest in the property as we start.
So your argument is, I understand it, answering the questions of my colleagues here, is that it depends on what the deed said in each instance. In other words, if in 1968 had you conveyed this property, or if your original deed had been worded in a different way, it could be a different case.
Exactly. Neutral principles of law.
Under the neutral principles we're talking about.
Absolutely. I would, and I'm saying that should be, when the Chief Justice said, how would I write this opinion? That's what I would say. I would say, this is, ELO gets its church back, and the Methodist Church should make an immediate request for trust deeds from all of their congregations. Just like they did back in the late 60s when they visited the subject, they recognized they wanted those trust deeds.
But it depends upon how the original deed is written in any event.
True.
You asked because you, under, in the, looking at this deed, the one that conveys where you took the property, maybe most deeds, or this might be an exception to how other deeds are written, as far as any reverter, as far as the powers of the congregation, et cetera.
Yes, sir, and that's exactly what I found as I reviewed cases. The outcomes were very dependent on how the original deeds were taken or whether a subsequent deed was given. You know, that there was this trust clause that I think that ELO certainly could have added more restrictions to itself in the late 60s when requested. They could have further confined their interest by giving a trust deed to the conference, just like at times they've given real estate mortgages to a bank when they needed to put on shingles or something, that they declared an interest in property. But to me, it's very important for parties to know that when I go to the Register of Deeds, that's the main place to find out who has an interest in property.
Counsel, you seem to be indicating, at least as I understand your argument, that Chapter 187 is not applicable to your client. Is that correct?
Under these circumstances.
And the circumstances would relate to the Lemon versus Kurtzman or LLN versus Clowder type of situation.
That would be the framework which says how far we can go, but the circumstances, I believe the deed becomes very determinative as to whether or not who gets the property here, but whether or not the statute is given a reading that would trump the deed. I'm saying that's an issue of constitutionality.
Are there any other reasons other than the constitutional concerns that you would advance in regard to why Chapter 187 is not applicable to ELO?
Only that when I picked up 187.15.4 and it said the triggering device, when I looked at that short statute, is defunct and dissolved, and I'm in the church basement with about 30 people who badly didn't want to lose the church that their parents and grandparents and presumably their children would attend. They didn't look defunct and dissolved. I don't know how we can escape the plain meaning of defunct and dissolved.
Chief?
Sir, Justice Brasser.
Could I ask you, sir, to describe, if you prevail, what property rights would you have? Would you be able to affiliate with another church and convey the property to the governing body of that church?
I believe that we're limited by the language on the face of the deed, which states that we could use it for another evangelical church, that we could sell it and the funds could go to another evangelical church. Otherwise, we're limited to a reverter to families from the original grantors, which when this came up in the paper, they showed up and said, Are we here, maybe? And why wouldn't they, I guess? I mean, it's a very local church.
If you prevail in the case, and at some point in the future, the church is dissolved, according to your definition, what happens to the church then?
The church board, if it exists, has a duty to follow the language of the deed. And it would have to take the property or the proceeds of the property and take it to another evangelical church. That would be the obligation under the my reading of the deed and what I think is a plain reading of the deed. But I don't believe that the UMC, the way the deed is prepared, has that long-term interest unless they happen to be there when it's defunct and dissolved, which has already passed.
Justice Babbage has a question, counsel.
Counsel, this may have been touched on or even asked, and if so, I apologize. 187.02 refers to existing societies confirmed and that they may reorganize. It says that every existing church congregation, et cetera, shall exist in the same manner until organized under this chapter. Was the Elo Church ever organized under Chapter 187?
I do not know. I just do not know, sir.
Isn't that a critical point? Because if you were never reorganized, 187.15 would never apply.
It's not a point that we have considered.
Okay.
Well, that would be, I think, in the Secretary of State's office, or it might be, which the court can get that information. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Furlow, representing the Wisconsin Conference Board of Trustees of the United Methodist Church.
Good morning, and may it please the court. John Furlow on behalf of the Wisconsin Conference Board of Trustees of the United Methodist Church. I'd like to, before I describe what I had planned to tell you, address Justice Babbage's question. In this case, in the answer, the local church admitted they were once a local Methodist church or society organized under 187, and that appears in record item number 3 at paragraph 21. And the admission is that they are currently not a local Methodist church or society within the meaning of section 187.15.4, but would admit that Elo United Methodist Church was such a society. That is in their answer to the complaint. What I would like to address really is the statute.
Check the Secretary of State's office. Did you check the Secretary of State's office? I'm making an assumption that that's where they would file a reorganization.
Your Honor, I have not made that check. I don't know if there is a filing there. The statute does provide 187.15.5 that any organization either organized or attempted to be organized under the predecessor of the statute, which goes back to 1849, organized or attempted, falls into this statute and then is subject to the rules and discipline of the church.
It says shall be valid corporations, but we're not challenging whether this is a valid corporation, right? And then you say it says be subject to the jurisdiction and discipline of the church. You think that's a constitutional, that language raises a constitutional issue?
No, because the court in Jones versus Wolfe, which is the seminal case on neutral principles and discusses the framework of this, discusses how churches should be able to self-organize and govern themselves. One way to do that is to look at a church constitution. Another way to do it is to look at a deed. Another way to do it is to look at other instruments that allow the church to self-govern. This kind of a statute is not new. It is the kind of statute that the Supreme Court specifically authorized in the Sharpsburg case. In Justice Brennan's concurring opinion, he said as follows. A third possible approach, and this is to resolve church property disputes, is the passage of special statutes governing church property arrangements in a manner that precludes state interference in doctrine. Such statutes must be carefully drawn to leave control of ecclesiastical polity as well as doctrine to church governing bodies. That is precisely what section 187.15 has done. Each and every section of that statute refers to trust obligations of trustees and identifies that those trust obligations must be carried out according to the rules and discipline of the church. Those trust obligations for a trustee of a United Methodist Church, back then known as the Methodist Church, were imposed as early as 1849, which was well before this local church received the deed. And those trust obligations really drive what is at issue here, because you not only have a trust deed, the deed is given to the circuit. The circuit is not simply the one local church we're talking about here. A circuit is a group of churches. So it wasn't even given to the trustees of this single church, it was given to the circuit. But it was given in trust for the Methodist Episcopal Church, and it is undisputed that the Methodist Episcopal Church is now the, well, the predecessor of what today we know as the United Methodist Church.
So my, I'll ask some of the same questions I ask other council, and this is going to the deed. So what I think you're saying is that regardless of what the deed says, that it's trumped by 187.15. I think that's what you're saying, but I would ask that if this court, and I think there are different approaches which you mentioned, if this court looks at only the deed itself under the neutral principles, how can you prevail if we just look at the property interest as referred to by your counsel? How do you think you prevail under that, the deed itself?
The deed on its face was given to trustees in trust for the Methodist Episcopal Church. It is a trust deed. That trust deed imposes a trust obligation to use the property consistent with the United Methodist Church. Now, the deed itself shows that the various levels of the United Methodist hierarchy are indicated. The local church is the circuit. The United Methodist Church is the, it's the name of the denomination. It's not a legal entity per se. But the deed also references the governing body, which is the annual conference. Each of those is indicated in the deed. The deed is held in trust. The hierarchical arrangement is recognized. Now, there's some discussion of contingent remainder interests, but there's no evidence in this record that the subscribers have ever taken any action to trigger that. And even if they could, under statute, by the 30-year rule, there's no recording that we are aware of in this record where they preserve that right.
Well, under the 1849 statute, it talks about deeding to trustees of the Methodist. The trustee should be chosen or appointed in any society of the Methodist Episcopal Church in the state, and that they take the take property in the name of the of trustees of Methodist Episcopal Church, which this 1860 document does say. They're trustees of the Methodist Episcopal Church of the Liberty Prairie Circuit, Wisconsin Conference. The statute goes on to say that they hold it in both at law and in equity, and have the power to acquire, hold, possess, and enjoy in trust with the church, the Methodist Episcopal Church, any lands, and to use or sell and convey the same for the peculiar benefit of said church. Now, the 1860 deed really does not follow the language of the statute.
Well, the deed does not repeat the language in the statute, but it says it's a deed in trust.
It says it's in trust, but then it does have terms of the trust set forth. Now, the statute has the terms of the trust set forth, but the deed says that they can distribute it and donate it or hold the same in trust for some other evangelical church. That's not in accordance with the statute.
Well, Your Honor, the deed does not mirror the statute.
That's right.
The phrase that you're referring to is a contingent remainder. There has to be some event that triggers that. It is not a reverter in the sense it is automatic. You'll see there are three conditions. There's no evidence about the conditions, and more importantly, there's no evidence that the subscribers have made the vote of two-thirds, which is required by deed, to trigger that reverter. And there are cases that discuss this very issue.
Who are the subscribers?
The subscribers
because you had here not a two-thirds vote, not a majority vote, you had a unanimous vote.
Well, we had one dissent who voted, plus we had the second part of the charge, Walcott, abstaining.
Okay.
And it's not unanimous in the sense that the church is not simply a local church. It is a conference. And it's unanimous only in the sense that certain people, less one dissent at one local church of 121, decided they wanted to do something different.
But who are the subscribers under this deed?
It's not clear under the deed. I believe it is Corliss, the Corlisses.
Well, it refers to a paper of 1860, which one assumes that those subscribers are no longer around.
We don't know, and that paper is not in the record of the court. And there's no evidence that was put in that the conditions were triggered. And at some point, you run into the statute that has a 30-year rule in it. If someone has an interest in property, they must record that interest at some point and assert it so that someone with an interest as well knows it is out there. And there simply hasn't been development in this record that any of those facts exist.
Well, the UMC didn't file anything until the state showing it had an interest.
UMC was named in trust under the deed itself.
So the deed continues on.
The deed continues on, Your Honor. And I'd like to address for a moment, if I could, the idea of this other request for a deed. Because
Counsel, let me just get this straight so I understand it. UMC was named, and in, as we know, that in 1968, the UMC asked for a deed. They didn't have it complied with. They said no. As I understand it, ELO said, we will not give you a deed. So the only deed we're talking about is a deed that existed since 1860. And what you're saying, you acquired your interest in that when? When did you acquire your interest?
The trust interest in this property was acquired in 1860 along with a deed.
And
it is given to trustees of a local Methodist church in trust for the Methodist Episcopal Church.
But
we held a trust interest at that point.
But counsel, that interest is an interest as a beneficiary of a trust, right?
True.
And under the statute of 1849, the interest would have been no, wouldn't have been anything more than beneficiary of a trust. Is that right? Let me ask the question in a different way,
sure.
Maybe. Under 187.15.4 that we're dealing with, what interest are you claiming pursuant to that statute?
The interest under the statute is the
title to vest.
Correct.
Okay.
Because you see, the vesting in the statute, Your Honor, simply enforces the trust obligation and responsibility that local trustees have, and that obligation has been since 1849.
This is my quandary. I look at the deed, and you have your interest, your ownership interest, is as a beneficiary of a trust. I even look to the Book of Discipline, and under 2501 titles to property, it seems that your ownership interest is as a beneficiary to trust. I might be wrong, but it seems to me that. And it is in the enactment of this statute in 1923 that provides for a different kind of interest. That interest is an interest to vest title in you, separate and distinct from an interest of beneficiaries of trust. And I want to know how you can bridge that gap. Go from a interest, which under the law is as a beneficiary of a trust, to someone who's entitled to have title vested in you? How can you jump?
Your Honor, I don't know that it's a jump as much as a slide. And let me explain that.
How can you slip slide away from that?
Well, I don't mean to say slip slide, but the point, I think, is this, that the property is held in trust for the United Methodist Church. At some point, if the local church that has the property holding it in trust becomes defunct or dissolved, at some point, then it is no longer being used for trust purposes. All the statute does is say if there is a time when the property held in trust according to the rules and discipline by statute becomes, the local church becomes defunct or dissolved, it shall then vest in the annual conference. In other words, it bumps up one level in the hierarchy to preserve the trust, you see, because the annual conference is not the same as the United Methodist Church. It is still held by the annual conference in trust. Because the church is the denomination, the annual conference is the governing body, the trust relationship continues and the statute simply preserves that.
And your part of your argument is that it became defunct and dissolved because of its lack of affiliation with the United Methodist Church, right? That's...
Yes, Your Honor, and I think if you're looking at the words of the statute, that you have to look at the sentence together. Whenever any local Methodist church or society shall become defunct or be dissolved, I don't think there's much dispute that there are people at this local church that are worshiping. I think it is undisputed as well that they are no longer worshiping in the United Methodist tradition, as evidenced by their own actions, taking signs down, hiring a non-United Methodist pastor, etc. So they are no longer a United Methodist, local United Methodist church or society. That, I mean, that's how the statute works together when you read all the words. You can't simply say it's empty and that's how the statute operates, because it has to be an empty something.
Well, let me see if I can summarize the positions of both of you. As I hear the argument, you are relying on 187.15.4.
And the discipline.
Pardon me?
And the discipline.
And that it's defunct or dissolved because it's not following the doctrines of the church, and it is deliberately disaffiliated.
Correct. And a resolution was passed by the governing body by reaching that conclusion.
Okay. So does Mr. Waddell look at 187.15.4. Both of you look at it to just see it differently. And both of you, I would say that on the words of the deed, you too are relying on the words of the deed.
That is correct.
You read that differently. Then
that's a fair statement.
That's what makes the lawsuit.
So it makes it interesting.
And really, neither one of you seem to be adopting what the court has explored, namely look back at 1849, or don't apply 187 to this lawsuit.
I missed the point, Your Honor.
The point is that you're willing to go under Chapter 187. You don't think we ought to depart from 187. Look at the laws of 1849 or some other doctrine.
Well, the statute is the one on which we proceeded, but you have to read it with the discipline, because the statute recognizes that how a church organizes
should
be respected.
Which part of the discipline?
2501, the trust clause. The trust clause, mm-hmm. Which is section 2501, if my notes are correct, which provides that title to all churches, local churches, is held in trust. And that discipline applies. It has been applied by many, many courts. It has been recognized by the United States Supreme Court in the trust clause, and it is the way in which the United Methodist Church, in the annual conference in particular, governs itself.
And there are cases from other jurisdictions that appear to hold both ways.
Your Honor, I would actually disagree with that point.
Okay.
There are two cases I can think of that have found the other way in a United Methodist context. One is the Haney's Chapel case, which is the Alabama case.
That's right.
In that case, it was quite clear that the governing body had I'm thinking of the Kentucky case. In the Alabama case, it was quite clear that from the beginning, there was never an intent by the local church to accept the benefits of the United Methodist Church, and in that case, the annual conference, the governing body. That fact is not present in this case.
Except, let me ask the counsel, because the vestments they did accept, are you saying that this case they accepted none of the benefits? Because in this case, the one before us, it seems that in 1968, there was that refusal, outright refusal to give any deed. What do you make of that?
But let me address that, Your Honor. There was much discussion on this during Mr. Waddell's argument. The reference for that comes in three sentences in Record Item 21. It is a conclusory sentence, and it says as follows. In the late 60s, the United Methodist Church made a request to Elo that they desired a trust deed for Elo's real estate. This request was not granted. Title to the real estate remains with the local church as provided for in the Constitution of the Methodist Church, Division 1, Article 6. That is the entire record on this discussion. It is a puzzling fact. It is inconsistent with the deed. The deed says it's in trust, so why would you ask for a new trust deed? And where is this deed that was asked for? What did it say? Did it say something different? Did it corroborate the earlier deed? We don't know. And to rely entirely on that one paragraph, which is hearsay anyway and without foundation, really would not, I think, do justice to the actual deed we have, the discipline, and the statute.
I guess you could correct me if I'm wrong. When I read that and read the brief, there were six or seven congregations that went in perhaps at the same time. Were you getting deeds from others, and this was an exception?
There's nothing in the record on that point, but we do know one thing, Justice Wilcox, that in the history, if you look at the history of this particular church, which is a Record Item 21, Exhibit A, you will find out that in the 1960s, the late 60s, when this merger with the Evangelical Brethren Union happened, the local church, the Elo Church, Methodist Church, the Ad Council, which is the administrative board, which is a body, changes the name from Elo Methodist to the Elo United Methodist Church. Now, why would you change the name from Methodist to United Methodist if you never intended to be part of the merger and wanted to remain independent? It makes no sense.
Well, would it make sense if you felt you were merging but you were keeping the property in accordance with the original deed? That's basically my question.
Well, it would be inconsistent, you see, because you still have the discipline to deal with. You have a local church who has operated and accepted benefits subject to a discipline. That discipline couldn't be clearer. Now, there's a provision of the discipline that I will...
You mean de facto, they would just say, well, your property is ours now. Once you affiliate with us, your property is ours, regardless of what the deed said.
Well, that's correct, because, I'll reflect on a portion of the discipline which is reported in many cases. It is not in this record. But I will represent to you the discipline is the discipline, it's reported. There was a provision in 2501 as to title that says if there is no trust provision in a deed, the property still is held in trust so long as the local church has accepted the benefits of pastoral appointments, has accepted the administrative and doctrinal framework of the church, and all of those things are true here. In cases like... I want to think for a moment, I can tell you. I believe the Starnes case sets out those provisions of the discipline. I can provide a supplemental filing if the court would like that. But you see, the discipline is not inconsistent. the idea that title is held locally and yet is subject to the discipline is completely consistent with the portions of the discipline that still impose a trust. And that trust, whether by deed or whether by implication, a resulting trust of sorts, must be enforced, because the impact of all of this is to create a situation where local churches have the ability, when they disagree with doctrine, to simply split away, take the church property, take all of those things that parishioners have given to that church for 140 years, expecting that they're used for United Methodist purposes, and use them for another purpose. That is not consistent with the trust.
I need help with the due process takings implications of this case. Again, as I look at the discipline titled 2501, and I know I've touched upon this before, but I just need some further assistance. The most that you had, your clients had, it seems to me, prior to invoking the protection of the statute, is a interest as a beneficiary in a trust. How can a statute change the nature of a property interest without there being some due process or takings implications, and how do you address those implications?
Well, there are two responses to that, Your Honor. The fundamental bedrock principle of a takings case is you have a property right free and clear from others. The local church never had that. They held a right subject to a trust interest. So the statute simply enforces the trust obligation when the local trustees decide to abandon their responsibilities as trustees to the annual conference in the United Methodist Church. The second principle is this, that it is well established, and I'm thinking of the Serbian Orthodox case, that when a governing body in a hierarchical denomination, and it's undisputed we are a governing body in that the United Methodist Church is a hierarchical church, when they make a decision that touches on matters going to religion, which they did here, the local church no longer operates for the purposes for which it was organized, that decision must be respected. The only exception to that is what's called the Gonzales exception, which is fraud or collusion or arbitrariness. And there was some discussion about, well, does the arbitrariness exception apply if the denomination doesn't follow its own rules? And that question was answered directly by the Supreme Court in the Serbian Orthodox case, where they said no. The fact of the matter is, a church and a denomination that is hierarchical is free to enforce its rules. Decisions are made as a matter of faith. And those decisions, even if they were arbitrary, must be respected. So with respect to the takings question, the property interest was limited, and the decision to enforce the trust must be respected. That is a First Amendment protection that the governing body has. And it's not just the Methodists. There are other denominations, the Presbyterians, the Roman Catholics, the Episcopals. Some churches, the Episcopals, passed the Dennis Canon in direct response to Jones versus Wolfe to make sure that their church constitution provided a trust interest. And that's provided for in the one of the cases we've cited where that history is set out. It's the trust responsibility and obligation that has to be enforced here. At bottom, what we're trying to do here, and this is not an easy case for the conference in many ways. The conference does not like to lose parishioners. It does not like to lose people who are unhappy with their denomination. But at some point, we owe an obligation to all of the local churches. The conference must enforce the rules, and the rules are clearly set out here. They were explained to the local church before the action was taken. There was discussion about this. There was 2 years of meetings to resolve this problem. And when their intentions were made known, we told them. The discipline provides that the property stays with the denomination and the conference. And it's not a very easy situation for either side here, but at some point the rules of the denomination must govern this situation, and they should be enforced.
Counsel, as an aside, was mediation tried?
Yes, there was an, I mean, this isn't in the record, Your Honor, if I can answer anyway. There was an offer to mediate. There were efforts to mediate. The bishop made personal visits up to the local congregation. The district superintendent made personal visits to the congregation. There were prayer meetings. There were lunches. And none of it worked. There was a lot of underbrush here, and it's very unfortunate from the county's standpoint that this did not get resolved.
I'm not sure if I'm on the same track. Was formal mediation, that is, using the services of a mediator employed, or I heard your response to be more that there were lots of discussions and attempts in resolving the matter, but not necessarily any kind of bringing in a third party to mediate.
Your Honor, there was an attempt at formal mediation, and again, this is outside of the record, and I apologize. I myself tried to hire a mediator to get this thing mediated, and then we had a big hullabaloo about, well, who's going to pay for the mediator, and who's it going to be, and are they the right denomination?
There was no formal mediation, but there were 2 years of discussions and trying to resolve it with the parties between and among themselves.
Your Honor, we tried very hard to get this thing resolved. It is not an easy thing for this conference to deal with. The Court of Appeals ought to be affirmed. Local churches are the bedrock of the annual conference in the denomination, and we need the search. It's a very concrete reason. There is only one parsonage for these two churches, the Elo Church and the Walcott Church, and that parsonage is next to the Elo Church. That's the only place where the pastor for the Walcott Church can stay. So we have a very pragmatic reason for wanting to keep the property in the trust relationship, and the impact isn't simply that the annual conference loses a piece of property, but it goes to other denominations who have set up trust arrangements, and it goes directly and perhaps as importantly to Walcott, another local church that will now be without a place to house a pastor. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Furlow. Mr. Waddle, you have about 5 minutes in rebuttal.
With no surprise, Mr. Furlow and I don't agree on many things. I see rebuttal as for me to just get on small items which come up. The parsonage. Waukaw had a parsonage, sold it, kept its cash. Elo had its parsonage and still has it. Okay. Two, the 2 years of meetings constituted basically, we get to keep the property if you do not agree with us, and we're here today. I think the heart of this thing today in front of you was the statement made by Mr. Furlow. The purpose for which it was organized. Why was Elo organized? Look at the face of the deed. It was made to house a local church at that time, a Methodist church, but the fallback wasn't to go up to the conference, but to go to the side to another evangelical church. The purpose is to have a local evangelical church, which they considered this to be when they said other evangelical. I will not go back through the recitation of who the parties were in the deed that I started with. I believe that that's clear. Another question came from the Chief Justice of Mr. Furlow and says, which part of the discipline are you referring to? I think that paragraph 6 is important because it acknowledges that some churches hold title outside of the trust and that nothing about the merger is going to disturb that. The next short spot that I guess I think we need to remember is we're reviewing two motions, a motion for dismissal and a motion for summary judgment. The only information that can be in this record is the record that's in there under those kinds of circumstances. There's an affidavit that says they asked for a trust deed in the late 60s and we refused to give it. And that's, I agree, that's the end of that subject as far as what the record has in it. But the record at that level doesn't have too much in it. I'm amazed how much it does have. We have these long, drawn-out affidavits and histories and so on, but they're there. There was a discussion of the 30-year rule as having some play in this. I think this court should look at 243.01. It's basically the statute of frauds as applied to trust. If you're going to enforce a trust, the person who's to be charged better have signed it. I think that that's important here. To say that when the vote was taken, that ELO was part of a two-location church and that Wacaw abstained, I think is straining credibility. Wacaw is one church, ELO's another. Out of the last 140 years, they've shared a pastor about 10% of the time. That's it. Jones versus Wolf says that you could handle this problem with a carefully drawn statute. I don't think that 187.15 sub 4 hits that requirement, and I'm not sure that Jones versus Wolf is right. I think to draw a statute that moves property from A to B without something more is incorrect. I think that the trust deed is such a light burden. If ELO intended at any point that it should be subject to giving up its property, they could have just done that. The parties could have done it. It's so easy. It'd be like an unrecorded mortgage. The thing that I'm looking at today as I'm standing here is I'm the president of a fraternity on campus. If our national passes a rule that says if you become defunct and dissolved, we get your real estate, and then we fight that when we become defunct and dissolved, and our court board says, no, that shouldn't be, are you going to require somebody in Kansas City to have something of record in the Dane County Register of Deeds? Or are we just going to look at his organic documents and say that's okay? And I'm saying that if you'd say, no, you need something more than just your own organic documents, I don't think that you can use these organic documents because that's preferential to a church versus another entity. I think that that goes to the validity of the statute.
Justice Brown.
You started out your comments indicating let's keep the eye on the ball. This is a summary judgment motion and motion to dismiss, which are both subject to the review. In your opinion, are there any genuine issues of material fact with regard to the summary judgment issue, or may there be? I know you're the one that brought the motion to dismiss, aren't you?
That is true.
Okay. Are there, when you responded to the genuine issue of material fact, summary judgment, that was denied, is that correct? That's the posture of it?
The motion was granted.
Summary judgment was granted.
Summary judgment, no.
Summary
I moved for motion to dismiss.
That was granted,
and
summary
and
judgment.
And Mr. Furlow moved for summary judgment, we prevailed, let's put it that way. Whether we prevailed as a motion to dismiss or whether we prevailed as a non-moving summary judgment motion, the Court of Appeals raised that
question. The Court of Appeals raised that and then just kind of jumped from it.
True, I would agree with that.
if your motion to dismiss is really a motion for summary judgment, are there any genuine issues of material fact? Or may there be? I don't want to...
The one issue...
Pitched against yourself.
The one issue that's there, and I again go back to that original series of questions from Justice Wilcox, is I believe that the deed, while difficult to read, is clear. Generally, the reading of a contract or a deed is something that your court can do de novo. The problem I see in this case is the handwritten version is very difficult to read. And I do not know whether that's an issue of fact as to what are the exact words on that piece of paper.
Is there a dispute between you in regard to the typed version, which is Exhibit C in the appendix? Is there a dispute?
I've never heard one raised throughout this litigation that the typed version, even though there are holes in it, doesn't touch on all of the relevant issues.
That's the only material issue of fact, or issue of material fact, I should say.
Well, I think the trial court looked at it very narrowly in the sense that he gave the pumped and dissolved their plain dictionary meaning, and there were no averments in the complaint that said there's nobody there worshiping, there's nobody keeping the heat on or the door closed or so on. There's no abandonment in the ordinary sense. And is the issue of what does defunct and dissolved mean a question of fact? I don't think so, because that was never there. It was a matter of, can the annual conference interpret those terms for the court? That was the issue.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Waddell. The court will take a few minutes recess so that people may leave if they wish, and our students from Mishicot may arrive. Court's in recess for 5 minutes. Would counsel approach the bench, please?